Patreon bonus episode. Today we're speaking to an independent researcher just known as BR. He wants to remain anonymous. He's going to be talking to us about the sad state of the Irish Defence Forces. So today we're going to be speaking about the Irish Defence Forces and the various issues that we've been speaking about. Before we get into all of that, maybe just give us an outline of what the Irish Defence Forces actually is. I know it's obvious, but there will be people who will be like, what? Ireland has a military? You know what I mean? So maybe just give us a rundown of that first.
Sure, yeah. So it's one of those topics that, you know, on the surface it looks pretty straightforward, but the more you read, the more kind of threads kind of unravel. But I'll do my best today to sum it up a bit.
No problem.
Essentially, the Defence Forces it's consists like most countries of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Corps. So Ireland has an Air Corps rather than Air Force, but I'll talk a little bit about that later on. So I'm not going to get into too much politics or anything like that, but essentially for years the Defence Forces have been I would say neglected by the government. It's definitely fair to say that they've been neglected. Whether that's been willfully or not is definitely open for debate. I think it is to a degree. You know, like Irish troops have served and are still serving abroad in a load of places. Like there's a UNIFIL mission in Lebanon. This kind of between 300 and 450 troops. You've got UNDOF in Syria, which is typically 100 to 200, that kind of bracket, and then Mali as well. So you've got like 100 to 200 troops there, as well as obviously some other deployments as well around the world. So, you know, Ireland has I would say probably a proud history of peacekeeping operations abroad. Of course, we also had operations at home during the Troubles. That's largely been scaled back, but of course there's probably some stuff we don't know about going on behind the scenes there as well, in terms of intelligence and that kind of stuff. So I mean, even the Navy was overseas. They were involved in the rescuing refugees from the Mediterranean a few years ago. There's a good documentary on YouTube about that goes into quite a lot of detail as well. So essentially the Defence Forces, it's internal security and then mostly external peacekeeping missions, I suppose that's fair to say. It started in the 60s with the Congo mission. I don't know if anybody's seen the film The Siege of Jadotville on Netflix, but essentially that was one of the first missions. And even then you could kind of see maybe the government's attitude to the Defence Forces at the time. You could probably say it was naive rather than willfully ignorant. You know, the troops were sent over with wool uniforms to the Congo. Mm-hmm. You know, it's crazy. They were sent with First and Second World War weapons and equipment. So you could say that was probably a bit of naivety, but certainly in the following years, there's probably a degree of malice is probably too strong, but definitely a degree of seeing the Defence Forces as an easy target for making cutbacks.
So essentially the Irish Defence Forces, or the Irish Defence Force rather, is the Irish military, but not on any overt assaults or anything like that, not on any like it's all peacekeeping missions, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Defence Forces did have a rotation to Afghanistan back when the, you know, NATO was there. And Ireland is in the Partnership for Peace. It's not a direct member of NATO. So anything that we do along those lines has to be, you know, go through some quite stringent checks before it's approved. And typically it's a small deployment. Like the mission to Afghanistan, for example, was between 7 and 12 troops, and usually there for assistance with kind of counter ID and post IED improvised explosive device scenes. Ireland has quite a bit of experience of that with Ireland itself in the border border regions, and Lebanon, they would have, you know, seen that kind of stuff quite commonly. So yeah, but you're right, you know, it's Ireland is, and again I can go into this a bit more later on, Ireland is on paper a neutral country, so we have this policy of neutrality, and yeah, I mean, even the Second World War, we didn't take part. We called it the emergency in Ireland, and secondly, we kind of, you know, we definitely took the Allied side, but we were on the surface neutral.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking a couple of weeks ago now, and you were telling me some stuff about the kind of neglect which you've touched on now. But you were saying essentially that the Irish Defence Force is really not in great shape. Maybe go into that. Explain to us what you meant by that.
Sure. So I would say that let's start relatively recently in the recession, say 2008. The Defence Force's establishment, so the total figure for the Defence Forces was scaled back. At the time, it made sense, I guess, economically. And since it's never been restored, so the official establishment or the official total strength of the Defence Forces should be around 9,500 to 10,000, but it's much lower than that at the moment, for a variety of reasons. So pay and conditions would be the first one you could ask. I would say anybody in the Defence Forces, they would say pay and conditions is probably their number one concern. I mean, you have soldiers in the Defence Forces that are sleeping in cars, they're getting social welfare because the wage they're receiving just isn't enough to support their families at times. And that's, you know, that's from a human point of view, so the human side of things. From an equipment point of view and from a technology point of view, it's even grimmer possibly. So the Defence Forces, Ireland, you know, we're you know, Northern Ireland is obviously attached to Ireland, but we're an island country essentially, and we have the largest maritime economic area in the EU. And we have 9 ships in total, 5 of which are being used at the moment. The other 4 are tied up just through lack of crew. We just don't have the crew to staff them. And recently, yeah.
Don't even have the crew.
No, the crew just isn't there. So you have guys coming in on a Friday off, you know, being at sea, and they're told, yeah, you're going to sea again on Monday, because they just don't have the crew.
Well, why is that though? Because there's not enough people trained, enough people aren't signing up. Why?
So for a good number of years, there was a recruitment freeze after the recession. So there's a recruitment freeze, except for officers. So there was probably too many officers compared to enlisted troops in the Defence Forces for a long time. The troops that are there, you could say, aren't being valued. You know, let's take a technician in the Air Corps, for example. What a technician in the Air Corps can earn on Civvy Street, so with a private company, is multiples of what they're earning in the Defence Forces. And if we go back to the pay and conditions question, essentially, the Department of Defense don't care about the Defense Forces, and it seems that they're not really interested in addressing the pay and conditions question. So, if you're a young technician, highly skilled with the Defense Forces, and you get an offer from a private company at Dublin Airport offering to double or triple your salary, why would you stay in the Defence Forces if you need to make a living? You know.
So this makes me think then. You know, God forbid somebody attacks Ireland, like it's not protected by the military, right? Well, I don't want to say not protected, but they don't have the adequate manpower and equipment and weapons, right?
But by no means. So if we take, I mean, we've discussed the naval service a bit. So they don't have the ships. The ships they do have are old. The oldest is from 1984. That's one of the ships that's kind of proposed to be decommissioned, 1 of 3, and replaced within 2 years. But, you know, we're going to have essentially a 6-ship navy for 2 years. So that doesn't make much sense. The Air Corps, for example, is so short-staffed. It's essentially a 9-to-5 organization. So they work Monday to Friday, 9-to-5. The aircraft they have are quote-unquote fighter aircraft are essentially trainer aircraft. They're turboprops rather than jets. That they're not fit for purpose. There's no way they can defend against anything modern. We have some helicopters, but again, essentially they're civilian helicopters painted green. Now, don't let me speak badly of the crew or the equipment. They're doing the best, and I think the aircraft are actually quite well regarded, but they're not dedicated military aircraft. And then the army is similar. So we have APCs, but they're not the most modern, would say. So they're made by a company called Moeg, and they've done quite well. But you know, you can see registration plates from the mid 2000s on those, so they're definitely due an upgrade.
So why is it then that the military in Ireland has been allowed to get to this point?
I kind of touched on it. It's seen, I would say, by the government and by successive governments. It's not just a one government problem. This hasn't happened overnight. It's been going on for many years. Essentially, it was seen as an easy target because the defense forces can't strike. So, you know, they can't threaten not to work and then, you know, go for better conditions. They do have representative organizations, but again, their powers are pretty limited, I would say, in terms of what they can actually negotiate for. They do their best for the members, but you know, the government knows that they can just not agree to what they want. I think the biggest issue is possibly the Department of Defense rather than the Defense Forces. The Department of Defense is a government branch, obviously, but it's not given priority by the government. So, for example, for a while they had a full Minister of Defense. Then this became like a sub ministerial role. So it was like the Department of Defense was assumed into other government departments. Right now it's under the government of the Taoiseach, so the government of the Prime Minister. So there's no real advocate for the Defense Forces in government sitting. And like I said, it's an easy target. So if you say to somebody, you know, we can cut 10 billion off the defense budget, which, by the way, is already the lowest in Europe, where we spend currently 0.3% of GDP on defense. That's comparably the lowest in Europe. Luxembourg, for example, has more capability than we do.
Joking me.
They have the Luxembourg example is pretty good one, I would say. They have heavy lift capability, so they have, you know, heavy transport planes. They have access to heavy transport planes, and we don't. So, for example, when countries were evacuating from Kabul airfield recently, Irish Ranger Wings, so the Irish Special Forces, which are again very highly regarded around the world, they were sent to Kabul. But they had to fly to France first. And when they got to France, they were taken by the French to Kabul airport. And then when they got to Kabul airport, they had to essentially, a mixture of Department of Foreign Affairs and Rangers had to beg lifts off French, Germans and Finns. So it meant that Irish citizens or people Ireland was taking in from Afghanistan were taking seats from people who were going to go to Germany or France or Finland otherwise. So that's at a very basic level, you know, heavy lift capability, something that every country should be able to provide. So that's one thing. So it's just not a priority for government because it's an easy target, because in the main, I would say Irish people are very apathetic towards defense, apathetic at best, unknowledgeable on defense matters, I would say. If you ask most Irish people, what do you think of the army? They would say, firstly, we don't need an army, we're neutral. Which is, again, I'll go into the neutrality thing in a little minute, but we don't need an army, we're neutral. So yeah, easy target. Government sees that, so there's no votes in defense, I would say. And you know, the other side is that I would say, until recently, I thought the anti-war lobby, I suppose, or the anti-war coalition in Ireland was quite strong. But following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I would say it's more of an anti-NATO / anti-West lobby, because if we take the Iraq War example, 100,000 people marched on O'Connell Street in Dublin against the Iraq War, justifiably. Very few people marched in Dublin at the Russian embassy against the Ukrainian at the invasion of Ukraine.
But Ireland has been doing a lot though for refugees, a lot more than Britain.
That's right. And to the credit, the defense forces again have stepped up. So the defense forces have built a tented village in one of the camps in Dublin to take maybe overflow if we run out of space in hotels or in private homes. But again, that's another area where we've fallen down. We could be doing better. The defense forces were urged to buy field hospitals, so tented hospitals from Slovakia, and it was turned down because it was just a cost-saving measure. And now that's kind of, I would say, coming back to bite us. I mean, Simon Coveney, the foreign minister, he was saying, you know, this invasion of Ukraine has taken us all by surprise, and it's taken, you know, us by surprise. We need to take security more seriously. But, you know, there's been a few dedicated people in Ireland who've been calling for defence reform for a good number of years now. So it's not a surprise to anybody who's halfway clued in.
Mm. Weren't there a situation as well around the Kabul pullout where I think, like, I don't know if like Irish troops got left behind somewhere or they didn't have food. They were stuck somewhere, right?
I don't know if we're talking about the same thing, but it happened recently that a couple of Defence Forces officers were stuck in the Congo.
Maybe it was
essentially
that.
Yeah, so the situation in the Congo kind of deteriorated recently, and other countries were pulling the troops out, and Ireland couldn't because we didn't have our own native heavy lift capability.
That's it, yeah.
And we couldn't get seats on planes, essentially. So it's just, I would say, an abdication of responsibility from the government to do something like that, you know.
It's quite embarrassing as well, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Ireland, we always, I would say, if you look at Irish statements at the UN and stuff, we beat our chest about being being a world leader in democracy and a world leader in peaceful negotiation and all this kind of stuff. But I think that's kind of a bit misplaced, kind of misplaced praise at times.
Well, if you want to defend democracy, unfortunately, you have to have weapons and you have to have a military capable of doing it. Not to say that anyone's coming to invade Ireland anytime soon. I mean, I'd say the biggest threat is probably like Britain or something, you know what I mean? But, you know, you need something, you know what I'm saying? And a lot of people don't seem to realise this. I don't know why, but Ireland is not in NATO. Yeah, a lot of people don't. For some reason, I don't know why they think Ireland's in NATO. So if they get, I mean, if somebody comes and invades Ireland, like what the fuck are they going to do?
Well, I mean, this was kind of a wake up call for me personally. So, I mean, the assumption among a lot of people in Ireland is that if somebody invaded Ireland, America and the UK and France and Germany would help. I mean, I guess European countries would be bound to, but you know, say if Ireland wasn't a member of the EU and they got invaded, you know, you could see a situation similar to Ukraine where we would get material support, but not necessarily direct support that we would kind of have assumed we would get. You know, it's you know, you can say that who's going to invade Ireland, but Ireland's like a super easy, I guess, staging point for international relations. If we look at, for example, the Russian naval exercises that were supposed to be held off the south coast of Ireland,
yeah,
or multiple Russian incursions into Irish airspace by you know, their bombers, Tu-95s, I think. Most Irish people don't know that the Irish airspace is actually protected by Britain. So if a Russian airplane overflies Irish airspace, Britain will scramble jets to intercept, not Ireland, because we can't. Similarly, we don't have radar capability capable of tracking these incursions. So again, we're relying on Britain for that. The naval exercises, we could monitor the exercises insofar as we could send up planes to kind of shadow boats and stuff, but we couldn't track them. You know, we could send up planes, find them, and then once we went off station, we couldn't track them. That's one aspect. The other aspect that a lot of people think about or don't think about here, I think, is that there's a lot of multinational companies in Ireland. You know, the headquarter of Twitter's here, the headquarter of Meta's here, the headquarter of Microsoft is here for the EU. And all of these companies rely on the internet. how do you stop the internet? You cut the cables, as we've seen recently near Sweden. And we just don't have the capability to defend against that. We don't have any ships with anti-submarine capabilities, for example. And it's kind of very neglectful, I would say, to leave ourselves so open like this. Because, yeah, you know, Ireland is a country that's very closely tied with the EU. We love being in the EU here, and we've seen a lot of benefits from being in the EU, from infrastructure projects to, you know, other things like that. And, you know, we're kind of one of the first countries to go to Brussels and ask for stuff. But when it comes to actually stepping up and defending the EU, as I would imagine is a responsibility of members, then we're dead last. Comfortably dead last.
Is there anyone like in the government advocating for taking, you know, the defence more seriously?
There is an opposition an independent politician called Cathal Berry, Dr. Cathal Berry. He was actually a former member of the Army Ranger Wing, sort of the Special Forces.
Yeah,
and he was either head or second in command of, I think he was second in command of the Ranger Wing, and he was head of military medicine. And he's since left the Defence Forces and worked as a GP, a doctor, like a local health doctor. And he's been a strong advocate for the Defence Forces in government. Side by side with that, there was a commission recently on the Defence Forces. So it was called the Commission on the Defence Forces. And it was chaired by academics and some members of kind of some other European members. I know some Finns were there, for example. I know Ireland works quite closely with Finland on peacekeeping operations, so it makes sense to have input from Finland. And they were very, very, very highly critical of not the Defence Forces per se, but more the Irish approach to defence. I think their idea was that the Defence Forces are doing the best they can with what they have, but their hands are tied behind the back.
And I don't know if you would know, but do you know the kind of feeling amongst the Irish Defence Forces about the situation?
Yeah, morale. So there was this report, I'll touch on that in a sec. So before the report, the morale was very, very low. And again, that's just down to pay and conditions. And, you know, basically feeling like, well, why would I put in effort when it's not going to go rewarded? You know, you've, like I said, you've lads and ladies coming off patrols at sea, and they've been told they're going right back, and you know, I don't care if you have a family, that kind of stuff. And of course, in every military, that is needed to a degree, but this is purely down to neglect. So paying conditions are a big thing, and morale was very low, and I would say still is quite low. Now this report, so the Commission on the Defence Forces report, was released. I don't really know. I don't really have a touch point for what it's been like since, but I would say that the maybe the level of morale is kind of let's wait and see, or I'll believe it when I see it. But essentially, in the report, there was three levels of ambition. So LOAs kind of outlined 1, 2, and 3. Level one was you know, it maintain the status quo. So strongly not recommended, because really the Defence Forces is taking over. At best, it's barely maintaining itself with the money that we have. Level two recommended a 50% increase in the Defence Forces budget, so up to 1.5 billion euro, which is not a huge amount, for example, I think. And this kind of 1.5 billion would plug gaps and allow for some expansion or investment in Defence Forces. And then level three, which was the most recommended, which was a 3 billion euro investment in the Defence Forces. So the budget, which would bring Ireland kind of more in line with similar countries, you know, countries of a similar size. Yeah, so it kind of remains to be seen. Of course, when the report was released, the government response was kind of, okay, now we need to commission our own working group to try and implement this report. But, you know, it's kind of reports about reports kind of thing. So you can see them kind of kicking the can already.
And what's the kind of recruitment like? Do you have a low recruitment, like each year, a lot of people joining or not?
They get people in, for sure. They're not it's not like it was, I would say, at the height of, you know, during the recession and stuff, or slightly before the recession. The Defence Forces was seen as quite a good job, and they had to turn hundreds, if not thousands, of people away.
Really?
From joining. Yeah, it was at the time it was quite a highly regarded job. Mm. Now I don't quite know. I mean, I think a lot of bad press has come out about the status of the Defence Forces. So it's, I mean, if I asked any of my friends in the army or the Defence Forces wider, they would tell you not to join up.
Why?
It comes back to paying conditions, I'm afraid. It's just it's not worth it.
What do you think can be done to rectify it?
It'll take money. I mean, it's something like this can't just change overnight. It'll take probably government leadership, which I'm not sure is going to be there. It's going to be forthcoming because, you know, Ireland has a number of crises at the moment. We've got like a health crisis. We've got a homelessness crisis. So if somebody's saying, you know, we need to spend $3 billion on the Defence Forces, Irish people are going to be like, well, I think it's like everywhere where people say, but what about this problem and what about that problem? Not really realizing that you can tackle two problems at once. Like, for example, the health service is notoriously bloated here. There's the frontline nurses and doctors are highly praised, but not enough. And then the kind of middle and upper management, there's too many of them and cost too much. If we take, for example, if you wanted to lease some fighter jets, so Ireland doesn't have fighter jets, and I think it doesn't make much sense to actually buy fighter jets, but you can lease fighter jets. For example, a Saab Gripen, a squadron costs around 100 million per annum, which obviously is a lot of money. But if we compare that to the health budget, that's around 2 days of health spending.
I guess it's not looking too good. Big mess. Is there anything else you want to say, mate, about this situation?
I mean, I'm kind of cautiously optimistic with the report and the advocates that there are in government. It'll take a bit of work, and honestly, I think it's a responsibility of the government and the country to step up and actually maintain the Defence Forces, because they can't do it themselves, and unfortunately they are needed, you know. The Defence Forces are needed, so it's going to be a case of ripping the plaster off, but actually seeing the benefits in the long run.
Yeah, all right, mate, thanks very much, really appreciate your insights on that. I think it's something a lot of people have no idea about.
No worries. Yeah, happy to talk about it.